A charge to keep I have, a God to glorify, a never-dying soul to save, and fitted for the sky to serve the present age. My calling to fulfill. Oh, may it all my powers engage to do my Master's will.
Good morning. I told my family after last evening this was a good audience. You know that the person who's speaking depends on the feedback he gets. Is that true, Brother Jason? If you see a look of, yeah, I got that, or a smile on the face, or a nod of the head, or something, you're helping the message. You really are. And so I just want to let you know that here at the beginning. Last evening we talked about the kingdom society, and the takeaway from that message is that we must get beyond the concept that God's only purpose is to redeem people. That is His purpose, and it's a very important purpose, but it's a means to an end. It's not an end in itself. The end is a redeemed society. A society of people who live together and work together and carry out the kingdom ethics that we're going to be talking about and demonstrate to the whole world what it would look like if everybody obeyed the king. And God has always wanted a people. In the Old Testament, He wanted a people. He called out a nation to show to all the other nations what a kingdom would look like if God was the ruler. And that's what He wants in our age as well. So now we come to the kingdom statutes, the kingdom laws. What are the laws of this kingdom? Well, the teachings of Jesus, I'm sure, struck people as something that was fresh, something that was new, something that was vital. And the question came up, as it always does, is He a liberal or is He a conservative? Is He going to destroy our concept of Jewish life, or is He going to support? Where is He here? Is He a conservative or is He a liberal? Jesus clearly declares Himself in this next passage. He says, I did not come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am a conservative. Did you hear me? In fact, let me give you a little bit of advice. Always identify with the conservatives. Okay? It was the conservatives in Jesus' day that finally believed after the resurrection. They were the Pharisees. They were the Sadducees. They were the liberals. They were the ones that had said there's no supernatural, there are no angels, there are no spirits, there's no resurrection, and no Messiah. We just follow some good moral principles in the law of Moses. That's what we do. We don't believe in miracles. We're rationalists. We're Greeks. They'd bought into a rationalistic concept of life. They were the liberals. You see, among the conservatives, there's always this concept of the miraculous, the truth of what God has said, an expectation of Him to work. And those are the people God works with. I mean, I've watched people put up tents. They're going to have revival meetings, and then I watch the people who go. The liberals won't be there. The liberal Mennonites won't be there. The United Methodists won't be there. The Lutherans won't be there. Who's going to be there? The Old Order Mennonites and the Amish and the conservative Mennonites. They're the only people who really believe God will ever work. And so they're the people that God works with. Now, they may be sort of dead. They may need some reviving, and there may be all kinds of problems with those conservative people. But they're the people who still believe in the principles upon which God can work. And once they're convinced, they respond, and things happen. So Jesus clearly came out saying, I didn't come to destroy the law or the prophets. Now, what are we talking about here? Well, Jesus was trying to help them understand that the universe is based on law. There's the law of gravity. There's the law of forgiveness. These are laws that they just work. If you don't forgive, you soon isolate yourself and you're all by yourself. You don't have any friends. The relationships won't work if you don't forgive. And if you forgive, then you'll have good relationships. And your marriage will work and relationships will work if you learn to forgive. That's a law. And Jesus was saying, I didn't come to destroy any laws that were built into the created order. That would be stupid. Because life operates by laws. And he said, and of course, the prophets came to call people to obey those laws. And Jesus said, I didn't come to do away with any of that. I came to fulfill it. The Mosaic law was added, but there was a law that preceded the Mosaic law. It was the moral law of the universe. The Mosaic law was brought in because the people weren't obeying that law. And God said, well, I just have to tell you, if somebody's animal gets lost and you find it, well, you take it and take care of it and give it back to your neighbor. How many think you would need a law like that if you'd really listen to what God has? You don't need a law like that. But the people were so dense in their moral perception that God gave the moral law to call them to what the laws of the universe were all about. But it was a temporary law. And Jesus said, I came to fulfill the law of the universe reflected in the law of Moses. I didn't come to destroy it. You can't destroy it. It's part of the created order. You can try to destroy it. You can try to destroy the law of forgiveness and be mean and nasty and unforgiving. But it'd be like trying to destroy the law of gravity. If you jump off a 20-story building and say, I'm going to fly, you won't break the law of gravity. You'll break something else, but it won't be the law of gravity. And so it's sort of stupid to try to defy laws that are just simply built into the universe. And that's what Jesus is saying. So the first thing he says here, let's read this little passage, verse 17 through 20. And we must move fast. You see, we have a lot of material here to cover in less than 45 minutes. Think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I'm not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled. Whosoever therefore shall break one of these least commandments and shall teach men so, he should be called least in the kingdom of heaven. Don't play games with God's law. This is how he feels about it. Even if you break the least law, you've broken a law. And that's serious. Because that's going to have consequences that are not good. And he says, whosoever breaks even the least commandment shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven, but whosoever shall do and teach them the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say unto you, that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, ye shall in no case enter the kingdom of heaven. Because the kingdom of heaven is all about an expression of God's laws and the beauty of what happens when they're obeyed. And that's what I want to convince you of this morning. The moral law cannot be destroyed, is the first thing that Jesus is saying. For instance, the bubonic plague broke out in the 1300s and 1/4 of Europe died. Do you know how that plague was ended? Somebody turned to Leviticus, not you, I'm saying somebody back at that time turned to Leviticus 13, 45 and 46 and read the law of quarantine. And they still didn't understand diseases at all, but somebody said, you know what? Suppose we took these people who had the bubonic plague and we isolated them. See what happens. And the bubonic plague stopped. They were obeying the law. In fact, they pulled it out of the law of Moses. In another case, in the Old Testament, they purified things by fire if they were metal. If they were not metal, how do you purify something that's not metal? Well, God told them, you burn a heifer and you throw into that fire cedar wood. And then you burn that, and then you put those ashes in a separate place. And when you need to purify something, you go get some fresh water and stir some of those ashes in, and then you use that to purify. Well, if you have a heifer burned with wood, what do you have? The ash from the wood is going to be sodium hydroxide. We know it as Y. And the heifer is going to provide a little bit of fat. And you're going to have a weak soap. Did your mother make soap, Jason?
Yes.
What'd she use?
And why?
Now this is thousands of years ahead. You know when soap was invented? 1700s. These people, thousands of years before that, were using a weak solution of soap before anybody knew anything about germs or anything about soap. By obeying God. And that's what Jesus is saying. The law cannot be destroyed. There are certain things that happen when certain things are done. And that's just the way it is. You can rebel against it. You can disobey it. You can defy it. You can curse it. You can do whatever you want to do. You will not change it. And the sooner we learn that, the better. And he says, now when heaven and earth passes, then obviously the created order is going to pass, and then there'll be a new situation. But now it would be senseless to defy the natural order. He says, whoever breaks one of these laws, see, the idea some people have is to throw off law and then we're free. That's not freedom. You end up in bondage. I used to take people to the nation's capital, and we could tour most of the things that were important in the nation's capital in one day. There was no security. You didn't take any time. You didn't have to have any tickets or anything. You could walk into the FBI building and tour the FBI building without any security. Now I go to Washington. We get about one thing done. Till you get through all the security and get all the clearances. We're a nation of prisoners because people are trying to be free. It's an irony. Who are the least in the kingdom of God? I want you to turn to something. I want you to turn to Isaiah 9:15. Oh, how this generation needs this message. I am grieved when I see people playing games with the law of the universe and thinking they're free and flaunting their freedom and bragging about it and trying to get other people to break the same laws so they can be free. Isaiah 9:15 tells you who is at the bottom of society. Isaiah 9:15. The ancient and honorable, he is the head. He's the head of society. There's the person at the top. The prophet that teaches lies, he is the tail. It doesn't say the murderer. It doesn't say the adulterer is the person at the bottom of society. It's the person who teaches lies. Why? Well, a murderer may murder a person or two, and that's terrible. I don't want to minimize that. But a prophet who teaches lies will destroy a whole society. It's a much more serious transgression. And so that's why he says, if you break the least commandment, you are going to destroy. You are a destroyer. Respect law is what Jesus is saying. Now, what was the least commandment? The Jews, did you know that the Jews had already decided which was the least commandment in the law? It was that law that says if you find a bird in its nest, you can destroy the birdies, but you cannot destroy the mother. That's in the law. And most of us go, what's the big deal? Ask the ecologists today what the big deal is. If you destroy the little birds, the mother still can have more birds. If you destroy the mother and then something happens to the birds, you're done. That's you're on the way to extinction for that species. And that was important to God. And so he put that in the law. And Jesus said, if you break even those little laws, you are a destroyer. Respect law. Kingdom participants are not blessed by breaking laws. The person that God honors and is called the greatest in the kingdom is the person who is able to instill into any society a tremendous respect for law and have everybody functioning the way that society is supposed to function. That's the person God honors. That's the person who's greatest in the kingdom. The person who learns what those laws are and he teaches them. And I'm not saying he commands people to obey them, but he gets people to inspire and gets them motivated to obey all of God's commandments of human relationships. Okay? So, that's the first thing Jesus says. The moral law cannot be destroyed. And the second thing he says is it can be fulfilled. You can completely fulfill the moral law. Now, the old law was as good as far as it went. People call on the phone and they talk all about God in the Old Testament and so on. And the things that are in the law, they don't like, you know, the punishments and all that. What kind of God would institute all that? And I say to them, you don't understand the Old Testament law. God gave the law in the midst of a society that was really gone bad. In Noah's time, he destroyed it by a flood. And then after the flood, it went just about as bad. And here was this brutal society. And actually what God did is he brought in a law to limit brutality. You could have a slave, but if it was a Jewish slave, you had to set him free at the end of 7 years. If it was a stranger, there was a law of the stranger. You could not abuse strangers. And, you know, you had to make restitution. If somebody took out one eye, you couldn't obliterate him like Simeon and Levi did one time. They obliterated a whole town because one person defiled their sister. You couldn't do that. That was before the law.
the law said that if a man defiled a woman, he had to marry her. If somebody took out your eye, you could take out an eye, but you couldn't take out both eyes, and you couldn't destroy him or his family or his town just because he knocked out your eye. The law limited retribution. It actually was helping to make society a little bit humane, but it wasn't at all complete. It wasn't at all complete. It didn't completely fulfill what God really wanted. That could not happen until Jesus came and took away the problem of sin and made it possible now for us to completely express what God wanted to have expressed. How many of you think we need a law of restitution? If you're really a Christian, that you need a law that says if you happen to kill one of your neighbor's animals, you must restore four. I don't remember all the details. How many think the Christian needs that law? In fact, I can tell you a situation where two brothers disagreed and they hated each other for 50 years. And finally, 1 year before the one died, they finally reconciled. And the reason for it was over property. And if that person who insisted on keeping the property would have just simply said, "Brother, what do you need? Yeah, you can have it. You can have it. You can have it." That's what the Christian does. In fact, if you want to know, the next thing Jesus says is that... Well, and that's, I wanted to say this yet. You know, everything moves towards its fulfillment. You have the seed, you have the plant, you have the blossom, and then you have the fruit. Somewhere in that was the Mosaic law. But Jesus said, now we're coming to the complete fulfillment and fruition of God's law, His moral law. It can be fulfilled. And how can it be fulfilled? He says, by a righteousness that exceeds. Well, what is a righteousness that exceeds? First of all, let's give a little bit of an illustration. How many of you see stars in the sky out there? You see any stars? Aren't there any stars there? Oh, they're still there. Well, why can't you see them? Come on.
Too much light.
The sun has superseded them. And that's what Jesus wants us to do with the law. We don't focus on the law anymore. The Bible says if we have the fruit of the Spirit, it says, against such there is no law. You've gone beyond the law. If somebody reads the law and says, you should do this, you've already done more than that. There's no, the law, it's not that the law isn't still there. It's not that the law should not still be obeyed. But you have responded in a way that the law has become, I don't want to use the word irrelevant, that's not quite right, but you understand what I mean. The law has become unnecessary. But you've fulfilled it. You haven't disobeyed it. People get the idea, well, you don't need to keep that law anymore. Well, my question is, what are you doing? Is what you're doing a fulfillment of what that law was? Are you exceeding that law? Don't throw it away unless you have fulfilled it and you have exceeded it. Until you've done that, the law still stands. How many understand what I just said? You want to see how to exceed the law? Turn to Luke chapter 6. And this, I always read this one with a twinkle in my eye. You know, I grew up with people discussing, now, if you loan a brother money, should you charge interest? Should you charge a brother interest? Some people think yes, some people think no. And I'm sort of amazed that that discussion ever takes place, because this is what Jesus said. Verse 32, if you love them which love you, what thank have you? And that word is charis, the word for grace, or it simply means, what Christianity do you have? What do you have more than your own humanistic strength? Because sinners can do that. And if you do good to them which do good to you, what Christianity have you? For sinners can do that. And if you lend to them of whom you hope to receive, what Christianity you have? For sinners can lend to sinners to receive as much again. But love ye your enemies, and do good, and lend, hoping for nothing again. Now, I was teaching an elderly men's Sunday school class one time when I was a young fellow. I always enjoyed teaching the old men and the old women because their peers, most of them, have died off and they're old enough. They have nothing to prove and they say just what they think. And that's why I like to teach the class, because you've got honest opinions from the old people. When you're younger, you know, you feel a little bit shy and a little bit intimidated by everybody else. But these old people lost all that. So when you ask a question, they just say what they think. And so while I was reading this, lend hoping for nothing again, some older brother just blurted out, "That's not lending, that's giving." That's right. Christians don't even lend. They don't talk about the interest. They don't even talk about the principal.
If you have more than you need, if there's somebody that needs something, you just give it to them. Now, if they're an honest person and have any respectability, they'll probably pay it back. But you make no arrangements even for the principal. That's exceeding the law. If you go back to the Old Testament, now we're talking about principal and interest. That's in the law. The Christian says, forget about that. I have a heart that just loves to help people, and I don't care whether it's paid back or not. I just love it. If I have anything to help somebody, I just help them. We don't even make any arrangements for repayment, and certainly not any arrangements for anybody to pay any interest. Sinners can do that. Sinners can actually lend money without interest. It says that. And the Christian can lend money without the principal. Now, I'm not trying to state an economic concept here. I'm just trying to show you that this is what Jesus said. He said, just go and exceed the law. Just go treat people like you would like to be treated. Okay? So, you fulfill the law by a righteousness that exceeds. Jesus did that. Judas. Do you know what Jesus did at that Last Supper? He seated Judas right beside him. That was why he was able to do what he did, to show John what John wanted to see. He seated him right beside him. That was a place of honor. He gave him the sop, which was a gesture of honor. There was no concept whatsoever that Judas was an enemy. In fact, when Jesus said, one of you is going to betray me, they didn't all say, it's Judas. We knew it all along. We could tell by the way Jesus responded to Judas. That's who it is. They all said, Is it I? Who is this? Jesus had treated Judas as an absolute friend, right up to the end. And so Jesus demonstrated this righteousness that just overflows and doesn't put any limits. It just exceeds. It's always running over. That's how you fulfill the law. And that's the kind of response that Jesus wants. So now let's talk about some of these statutes. We must move quickly. Jesus knew that we would need some laws to challenge our lazy wills and moral perception. He knows that we're lazy morally. He knows that we're lazy in our performance. And so he gave us laws. The New Testament is not an obliteration of law. It's a fulfillment of law. And so now he gives some of these. And they are high laws. Here is the law against anger. Let's read it. Ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not kill. And whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say unto you, that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause. Now take without a cause and just put a line through it. That was not in the original. King James had an enemy and he wanted that put in. So that was inserted without a cause. So just read it. Whosoever is angry with his brother shall be in danger of the judgment. And whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whosoever shall say, thou fool, shall be in danger of hell fire. Therefore, if thou bring thy gift to the altar, and there rememberest that thy brother hath aught against thee, leave there thy gift before the altar, go thy way, first be reconciled to thy brother, and then come and offer thy gift. Agree with thine adversary quickly, while thou art in the way with him, lest at any time the adversary deliver thee to the judge, and the judge deliver thee to the officer, and thou be cast into prison. Verily I say unto you, thou shalt by no means come out thence, till thou hast paid the uttermost farthing. Now Jesus here is talking about the very first steps to murder. And he says, check it. In my hymn book, I have a song that says, I want a principle within, a watchful godly fear, a sensibility to sin, a pain to feel it even near. Help me the first approach to feel of pride or wrong desire, to catch the wandering of my will and quench the kindling fire. And that's what Jesus is saying here. He says the first step to any mistreatment of any person is anger. The word anger here has the idea of constriction. It has the idea of something that narrows or strangles your emotions. I think we all know that feeling that when someone has done something we don't like or said something we don't like, there's this constriction of the feelings toward that person. I won't ask you to raise your hands. I think you all know what I mean. Okay. And Jesus says, deal with that. Deal with it right there. That sense of your heart constricting towards somebody. Feeling narrow and not very generous in your attitude toward the person. That's the first step to mistreating somebody. You know, before United States slavery could happen, they had to convince themselves that the blacks were less
valuable than the whites. And I could talk a long time about that. In fact, I grew up in a church. And you don't know the church I grew up in, so I can say this here in the West. The graveyard had bylaws. It said any person in the community may bury in this graveyard for a fee of $15 except blacks. That was actually in the bylaws of our graveyard. And a black family moved into the community to teach in the local school. This man was a professional man. They came to some meetings at that church and got converted and wanted to join, and the congregation voted against them joining that church. That's the church I grew up in. Now, they repented later on, and that's not true anymore. And that family is buried in the graveyard, by the way. So, but Jesus says that's the first step. You've got to have that attitude before you take the next step, which is contempt. Now, they tell me that the word raka, there is no such word in the Hebrew. But they say that this word actually, when they say it, sounds like what it is. Raka. You're about to spit in the person's face. That's your attitude. Now there's about to be a contemptuous action toward the person. That's the next thing that happens when you have a constriction in your heart toward somebody. That's inside. Nobody sees that. But sooner or later, it will be expressed in some contemptuous action. Something you say, some joke you make about the person, some belittling statement, something. There will be some expression of that attitude, and we all know about it, and it happens pretty prevalently among our people. And the reason it does is because we did not check the kindling fire, the constriction that we felt in our heart. We should have, like the Wesley said in that hymn, Lord, make us so sensitive that we sense that first movement of sin and check it right there. Now, you say, well, that sounds like a pretty high standard. Are you aware that for every command that Jesus gives, there's a promise? There's a promise in every command. If Jesus says you're to do it, then the promise is you can do it. How many understand what I just said? He doesn't ask us to do things we can't do. So if he says this is what you're supposed to do, there's a promise that he will give you the enablement to fulfill. And I need to explain to you another word that's completely often misunderstood, and that's the word grace. You maybe have all seen this little acronym, God's riches at Christ's expense. Okay, that's grace. How many have ever seen that little acronym? My question is, what is this? What are we talking about? What is it? Well, if you turn to Ephesians, I can give you a verse that doesn't have the word grace in it, but it completely defines that. It says, God has blessed us with all spiritual blessings, as some other translations have it, in the heavenly realm. God has blessed us with all spiritual blessings in the heavenly realm. So here's everything that God has. It's up here. Supernatural power, supernatural wisdom, supernatural forgiveness, whatever it is, you have an unlimited supernatural supply of it here. And grace is God making that available through Christ to little people like us. So if somebody needs something, you have the supernatural generosity of God to just give it, like we were saying. If you sense this constriction happening in your heart, God gives supernatural ability to free you from that. If you need to make a hard decision, you get unlimited. You get this unlimited. He's blessed us with all spiritual blessings in the heavenly places. My favorite verse in the New Testament is, God is able to make all grace abound. Tell me what the word abound means. No limits. The prefix ah means not. Ah typical, not typical. Ah moral, not moral. Ah bound, no bounds. God is able to make all grace abound towards you, that you always, having all sufficiency in all things, may abound unto every good work. I always say if that verse weren't in the Bible and somebody said something like that, I'd say, boy, they sure have an imagination. But it's in the Bible. God has given us unlimited supernatural resource. Now, He doesn't give it to us all at once. It'd be like putting 10,000 watts into a 10-watt light bulb. It would blow up. But what He does is, as you need it, He gives you all that you need and more besides for everything He's asked you to do. In every command, there is a promise
that you will be given all you need to do it. Now, what do you think would happen if every congregation would function with every member able to deal with the first movement of sin, the first attitude that's negative, the first constriction of heart? Everybody was able to apply this. Boy, you'd have the most loving congregation. You'd be the name of the whole world. They'd say, do you hear about those people at Halsey? They're amazing. They never have any relational problems. We've never heard them having any problems between any of their people. They just pour out love to each other like you wouldn't believe. So Jesus says the second step, if you don't do that, is an expression of that resentment, that narrowing, that constriction of heart. And finally, you have damning insult. Fool. You know what the word fool here is? You see? You're going to basically write the guy off as too stupid to even know which side of the sky the sun comes up on. You're just going to write him off. And if it's a brother, you're going to not greet him. You're just going to quit greeting. And by the way, the Bible says, if you treat a brother that way, you haven't said anything about him. You said something about yourself. It says, if you treat a brother that way, you're the one that's in danger, not him. If you damn him by some action of yours, you know, you're not even a Christian or whatever, you said that about yourself, not about him. Okay? I mean, this is really serious. We don't pass judgment on other people. It's God's judgment. And if we judge differently from God, whatever judgment we tried to pass, boomerang. And it comes back on us. This is serious. It's temporary insanity. Two procedures, Jesus says. Clear up offenses just as soon as you become aware of them. He says even if you're church and you're going to worship, and you remember that a brother has ought against you, you go and make it right with him immediately before you even come and worship. You can't worship if you have a relationship that isn't the way it should be. Because the Anabaptists had a statement, here's God and here are our brother. They said no man can come to God unless he brings his brother with him. That doesn't mean that when you want to pray that you have to go get everybody together, but it does mean that when you pray, everybody's in your mind, and you think, oh, there's that brother that our relationship isn't what it should be. I need to go immediately and make that right. If I want to come to God, he's got to be part of my prayer. I can't come to God till that's resolved. He won't hear my prayer unless everybody's with me in my relationships. So he says, clear up offenses. See, part of our problem is we don't really believe this is very serious. That's our problem. We've seen so many people who've had bad relations with others, and they were good people, and they wore their plain coats, and I believe in wearing plain coats, by the way. And they were just really holy people, and they were good, obedient church members, but they had bad attitudes toward everybody, and somehow they take communion, and that's okay. We've gotten so used to this. We need to become sensitive that this is really serious. Okay? We're talking about the kingdom of God. A kingdom society. This is what the world is supposed to see. A supernatural expression of the character of God among us. The second thing he says, oh, by the way, the one most hurt by bad relationships is the person who's created the bad relationship. I have a young man who's a bishop of a church who was one of my former students, and he told me, it's the same story that Corey Ten Boom tells. He said he had a dream, and he had this man that he never really liked very well, and in the dream was this man in a cage. And he was going around punching the guy in the cage. And the Lord told him in the dream, let the guy out of the cage. He said, no, Lord, I enjoy just hurting him occasionally, saying something nasty about him. And so I want to keep him in the cage. And the Lord said, let him out of the cage. Here's the key. And he said, finally, the Lord convinced him in his dream to let the person out of the cage. He said, I turned the key, opened the cage, and guess who came out? He did. He was the one in the cage. And we'll get to that later. This whole principle of forgiveness. Number two, make friends quickly with your adversary. Because anger is the kind of thing that the longer it festers, the deeper it goes and the harder it is to resolve. We had a situation in our community where an Iraqi young lady came to one of our Bible schools, and after the meeting, somebody said, and it was during the Iraqi war, the first one in 1991, somebody said, "She's an Iraqi." I mean, I can't imagine somebody with that mentality, but it was a child. I don't think their upbringing maybe was the best, but anyway. And so she came over, she was going to fight. And all he did was try to shield her with his arm. He didn't fight her. And she fell on her hand and claimed that she damaged her wrist. And that thing went to court. And they got sued. And they had to pay. And I talked to the lawyer, and the lawyer said, that would never have happened except for the incident that occurred after that. The mother went the next morning to try to solve this problem, and the mother of the girl was really pretty nasty, and the mother ended up telling her off. And he said, this is not about money. This is about honor. If that conversation had never occurred, you would not be here in court today. Agree with your adversary quickly, because anger festers deeper and deeper into the tissues of human relationships. And the quicker that can be resolved, the more possibility it is that it will be resolved. We must move to the next one, the law against lust. Now, I think most people would agree, if we could solve the problem of anger, which leads to violence and all the ugly stuff that you see happening, where people are hurting each other, if we could deal with anger and we could deal with lust, we would basically have solved the major problems of humanity. And so Jesus flags lust as another root of tragedy. It results in divorce, it results in abused women, displaced children. 40% to 70% of all children in this country are born out of wedlock. And it's all because of this whole problem. When I was a boy growing up, that wasn't true. There was one divorced man in the whole community, and he was looked down on not just by the Christians and certainly not just by the Mennonites, by everybody. He is a suspect character. He's divorced. One person. I went to public school. And among the whole student body, not just my grade, but the whole student body, grades 1 through 12, I only remember one family where there was a divorce. And now 72% of some children in certain parts of our society are born out of wedlock as a result of this mess. People were saying back at that time, we must be redemptive. We must be redemptive. So they started to permit divorce and remarriage in the Mennonite church. And now I'm looking at it 50 years later and I'm saying, who got redeemed? With all this redemptive behavior. The children didn't get redeemed. 72% of them don't have a home with two parents. The church didn't get redeemed. There's as much divorce and remarriage in the church now as there is in the world. Society didn't get redeemed. Would somebody tell me what got redeemed by all this redemptive behavior? You get the point? And Jesus said, the first step into this tragedy that we're enacting all across our country is to deal with lust. And again, if there's a command, there's a promise. Now, you young fellows are sitting here saying this is a pretty difficult thing. Is it possible? Jesus doesn't command impossible things. And he says this is really serious because you better cut off a hand or pluck out an eye. Now, I don't think he really, I don't know what he meant. But what he was saying was this is really serious. Even if you have to do the unspeakable violence to deal with it, it's a serious issue. The kingdom of God is free from the blight of lust. What is lust? We have a billboard that says, lust will drag you down to hell. And people call and say, what is lust? And I say, lust is a God-given desire that got out of control. It's in control instead of you. It's controlling you instead of you controlling it. And the only way that our desires are under control, whether it's eating, whether it's lust, whether it's any of our desires, is by conscious action. Now listen, I know that. Those people who are over 40 years of age know it doesn't just happen. You have to consciously deal with the problem. Okay? Right, Brother Jason? It's conscious activity. All right? And so the Bible says, keep your heart with all diligence. My favorite verse in the Old Testament. Keep your heart with all diligence, for out of it are the issues of life. You live by your desires. And how do your desires get there? You put them there. by the decisions you make. You make your decisions, and your decisions make you. Did you hear what I said? Let's quote that together. I'll say it, and you say it with me. You make your decisions, and then your decisions make you. Let's say it. You make your decisions, and then your decisions make you. You see, there was a hermit up on the top of the mountain. He came down after 30 years, and he saw these little yellow things in the market that he never saw there before. Somebody had invented a refrigeration, and there they were. And he said to somebody, "What are those?" And they said, "They're bananas. You should eat one." "No thanks. I already have more desires than I can fulfill, and I will not add another one." Now, that's sort of a silly story, but it's true. If you never eat a banana, you'll never be hungry for a banana. Desire is created by actions. It's the things we do. It's the things we say that then become part of us. Everything. Everything. That's why we limit videos with our children. Because if they watch videos, they have a desire to watch videos. And the more videos they watch, the more desire to watch videos they have. In a world where almost none of them are fit to look at. So we try to deal with the desire. We try to make sure the desire doesn't get planted there. That's not saying we never look at one in an educational situation. But we limit. We don't want to really get a strong desire for videos. Because you make your decisions, and then your decisions make you. And so, young men especially, be really, really careful what you program into your heart. God says, if you want to have a kingdom, society, to show to the whole world what it looked like if everybody obeyed the king, you must deal with lust successfully. Okay? Then he mentions divorce and remarriage. Let's look at verses 31 and 32. It hath been said, "Whosoever shall put away his wife shall give her writing of divorcement. But I say unto you that whosoever shall put away his wife saving for the cause of fornication causeth her to commit adultery. And whosoever shall marry her that is divorced committeth adultery." Now, people go back. The redemptive thing that they started to do and the exceptions they started to make is based on Matthew 19, where this is said. Whosoever putteth his wife away his wife saving for the cause of fornication and marrieth another committeth adultery. And so they say, oh, there's an exception. If the wife has been unfaithful, then there can be a divorce. Well, the interesting thing is that so-called exception statement, saving for the cause of fornication, is right here. And I want you to look carefully. It says nothing about remarriage. Nothing in this passage. So what am I saying? Well, this gives us the definition for that exceptional statement. What is he talking about? Is he talking about conditions for remarriage? Obviously not, because he says nothing about it here. What he's saying is, if a man puts away his wife, and she was innocent, if she commits adultery, it's his adultery. It's showing how a man can commit adultery without doing it himself. How many just understood what I just said? You didn't understand. Okay. It's saying that if you put away your innocent wife, and she commits adultery, it's your adultery, because you caused the problem. You created the conditions for her sin, and so you're responsible for her sin. She's responsible too, by the way, but you're responsible. That's what it's telling you, how a man can commit adultery without doing it himself. Now, how many understand? So when we go back to Matthew 19, we have to understand that that's what he means by that exception statement. And what he's really saying in Matthew 19, I'm absolutely convinced, is there are two ways a man can commit adultery. He can put away his innocent wife, and when she sins, he's committed adultery, or he can go and do it himself. There is no exception here. It's only telling you how a man can commit adultery without doing it. All right? This is a very serious problem. And we won't talk any more about that because we have a lot more to talk about. The law against swearing oaths. Oaths result from a man's strong tendency to lie. We all have a tremendous struggle to tell the absolute truth. Sometimes we tell part of the truth, but we leave out the part that would really tell the person what he needs to know. That's lying too. And Jesus says, the standard for my kingdom is absolute honesty. Now, what were the Jews doing? They were using the permission that God gave in the Old Testament to swear an oath. They were using it for their advantage. All right, I want you to notice something. It says here in verse 33, ye have heard that it hath been said of by them of old time, thou shalt not forswear thyself. There is no such command in the Old Testament. Forswear means overswear. It means swear more than you really need to. And so they said, if you swear by heaven, how does he say it here? Swear not at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne. See, if you swear by God, then that would be an oath you better keep. But if you swear by heaven, that's not really quite as much, so you don't have to be quite as honest if you swear by the heaven. What they were doing is they were adjusting their honesty. They were adjusting the oath to the honesty. So what you did is you swore the least you possibly, you got the least collateral involved in your swearing. So if you swore a little oath, then you could do a little bit of lie. If you swore a big oath, then you had to keep it. So you adjusted your oath to how much honesty you wanted to practice, rather than adjusting your honesty to the oath you swore. How many understand what I just said? I know I talk fast and I lose people. So what they were doing is they were adjusting the oath rather than their conduct. And Jesus said, this is stupid. Let your yea be yea and your nay be nay. Quit trying to grade your honesty by grading your oaths. That's the law against swearing oaths. I have a brother-in-law that says that that Jesus' statements here, you've heard that it has been said, is not anything in the Old Testament. It's that they added. You've heard that they added this to the law. He's just simply reinstating the law. And so I said to him one time, where do you find this? Thou shalt not forswear thyself in the Old Testament. And he said, well, that's a long discussion. We don't have time for it right now. It's not there. You won't find a verse like that in the Old Testament. What did Jesus say? He said, swearing is irreverent. Everything is related to God. Heaven, earth, Jerusalem, they're all associated with God. And if you use any of them, you're still absolutely required to tell the truth. Swearing is irrelevant. It doesn't help anything. And swearing is unnecessary. Okay? The law against resisting evil. Let's read this one. Ye have heard that it has been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you, resist not evil. But whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if any man will sue thee at the law to take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak. And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain. Give to him that asketh of thee. And from him that would borrow thee, turn thou not away. Now, the church kept this law of Christ until 200 A.D. Now, this subject is a really important one to me, and I want you to hear me. It's indisputed. If you're ever talking to anybody about this subject, remember that for the first 200 years, history absolutely clearly says that the Christians obeyed this commandment for 200 years. The church did not permit the use of violence. Did not permit the use of retribution, physical violence, for 200 years. And by the way, that was the 200 years of the Pax Romana, the Roman peace, where there was no major war anywhere in the world during those 200 years. Your history books, in the public school at least, said that was because the Roman army was so fierce and so brutal that nobody dared to defy them. The early Christians said, the reason for this Roman peace is because Jesus has come and have set up his kingdom of peace, and their example and the power of their testimony and their prayers are keeping the devil from causing major trouble in the world. And that ended when the Christians compromised and decided they could take the sword out of the sheath and Christians could have a sword. Constantine did that in 313. And then the united church and state. And then all the mischief broke out. The conquest of the Muslims by Christians using the sword is a horrendous story if you read exactly how all the slaughter that Christians did in those crusades against the Muslims. The Inquisition, where Christians tortured and burned other Christians at the stake. The conquest of the American Indian preached as the thing Christians should do. They were the heathen, just like the Old Testament Canaanites. Let's get rid of them. That was preached from the pulpit by Christians. The enslavement of American blacks by Christians, defended from the pulpit in this country. The war to end that slavery, where Christians killed each other on both sides, and even Abraham Lincoln in his second inaugural address said they both prayed to the same God, but both prayers could not be answered. I mean, this is just nothing but confusion. The conquest of American South America under the sign of the cross. the wars in Europe between Protestants and Catholics, and then between Protestants and Protestants that raged for years up until just a couple hundred years ago. All of that because they disobeyed Jesus here. They talk about a just war theory. Nobody has ever been able to say which side was just. I told you in the Civil War, they both said they were just. This thing is just a major... When I talk to people about this and I start to talk to them about the example of the early church, and I say, and it didn't end with the early church. You have the Waldensians who created these beautiful societies of peace. You have the Anabaptists. You have the Moravians in the 1600s. You have the Wesleys, who basically conquered the problems in England without lifting a sword. You have these examples of how God is able to work when people put the sword in the sheath and leave it there. And that's what Jesus says. He says, you are to be non-resistant. And for 200 years, I say the church was. And they won great victories. The early church basically won the heart of the Roman Empire by this. This is not surrender. This is strategy. It's cooperating with God. It's allowing the laws that He has created to go into effect. We stand back. The Bible says, vengeance is mine. I will repay, saith the Lord, so you don't do it. And then God can step in. Our Anabaptists won all the Western freedoms that we enjoy. Freedom of religion, separation of church and state. That was won at the stake. That wasn't won at the battlefront. It's just a tremendous concept. Well, these people, they go to the Old Testament. And they say, well, in the Old Testament, God commanded people to kill. And it says in the Old Testament, love your neighbor. And we don't have time to turn to it, but you go turn to that passage, love your neighbor. Just shortly after that, it says, Moab and Ammon, don't take them into the congregation forever. They are to be your enemies forever. Love your neighbors yourself in the Old Testament meant your Israelite neighbor. It didn't mean everybody. That's why when the Good Samaritan story was told, when Jesus said, love your neighbors yourself, from the Old Testament, quoting, the man said, and who is my neighbor? He knew that. He knew that the only person he was commanded to love was his Israelite neighbor. In the New Testament, there is no such thing. It doesn't say love these people, but not these people. It says, be gentle unto all men. Now, I don't know how you're gentle with somebody when you're shooting them. Maybe there's a way to shoot somebody gently. I've never heard anybody describe that. It says, live peaceably with all men. Do violence to no man. You don't find anything like this in the Old Testament. This is a new moral standard. Okay? There are no conditions placed upon our love and forgiveness in the New Testament. There are two kingdoms. That kingdom uses violence, and God has placed the sword in their hand to take care of evil and nations to correct each other. That all happens in that kingdom. But God is calling out a group of people, and He's saying, look, there was a time when none of that stuff happened, and I want to show the world what that would look like. So I'm taking the sword out of your hand. And I want the world to see what the world could have been before sin came into the world. I want the world to see what society still can be with the forgiveness and the power and the love of Christ. I want the world to see that.
If you don't have any takeaway from this meeting, I want the takeaway to be that He wants not just redeemed people. He wants the world to see a redeemed society. That's what the kingdom of God is all about. When I hear people talk about the kingdom of God, they usually are talking about a kingdom ethic, personally. And it is that. But it's more than that. It's a kingdom community. The Anabaptists have always put an emphasis on the church, but I'm not sure they connected it very well with Jesus' teaching on the kingdom. That's what He's talking about. He's talking about a kingdom society. And then He talks about the law of love. Let's look at this. Ye have heard that it hath been said, thou shalt love thy enemy. Thou shalt love thy neighbor, and hate thine enemy. But I say unto you, see, that was Old Testament. You should love your neighbor, your Israelite neighbor, and hate your enemy. I don't know if the Lord said you should hate them, but in other words, you did not have to treat them the way you treated your neighbor in love. You've heard that it has been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that ye may be your children of your Father which is in heaven. For He makes the sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and send His rain on the just and on the unjust. For if you love them which love you, what reward have you? Don't even the publicans the same? And if you salute your brother only, what more do you than others? Do not even the publicans so? Be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect. And it's time to end. I will conclude with a story. This story was related by a colonel in the Austrian army. I was commanded, the old colonel began, to march against a little town in the Tyrol and lay siege against it. We'd been meeting stubborn resistance in that part of the country, and we felt sure we should win because all the advantages were on our side. My confidence, however, was shaken by a remark made by a prisoner we had taken from that part of the country. "You will never take that town. They have an invincible leader." "What does the fellow mean?" I inquired of one of my staff. "And who is the leader of whom he speaks?" Nobody seemed to be able to answer my question. So in case there should be some truth in the report, I doubled my preparations. As we descended through the pass in the Alps, I saw with surprise that the cattle were still grazing in the valley and that women and children, yes, and even men, were working in the fields. "Either they're not expecting us, or they are laying a trap to catch us," I thought to myself. And as we drew near the town, we passed people on the road. They smiled and greeted us with a friendly word and then went on their way. Finally, we reached the town and clattered up the cobble-paved streets, colors flying, horns sounding a challenge, arms in readiness. Women came to the windows or doorways with little babies in their arms. Some of them looked startled and held their babies closer and went quickly on with their household tasks without panic or confusion. It was impossible to keep strict discipline, and I began to feel rather foolish. My soldiers answered the questions of the children, and I saw one old warrior throw a kiss to a little golden-haired child on a doorstep. "Just the size of my Lisa," he muttered. Still, there was no sign of ambush. We rode straight to the open square which faced the town hall. Here, if anywhere, resistance was surely to be expected. Just as I had reached the hall and my guard was drawn up at attention, an old white-haired man, who by his insignia I surmised to be the mayor, stepped forth followed by 10 men in simple peasant costume. They were all dignified and unabashed by the armed forces before them, the most terrible soldiers of the great and mighty army of Austria. The mayor walked down the steps straight to my horse's side and with a hand extended cried, "Welcome, brother." One of my aides made a gesture as if to strike him down with his sword, but I saw by the face of the old mayor that this was not a trick. "Where are your soldiers?" I demanded. "Soldiers? Don't you know we have none?" he replied in wonderment, as if I had asked, "Where are your giants or where are your dwarfs?" "But we've come to take this town." "Well, no one will stop you. Are there none here to fight?" At this question, the old man's face lit up with a rare smile that I will always remember. Often afterward, when engaged in bloody warfare, I suddenly see that man's smile, and somehow I have come to hate my business. His words were simply this: "No, there is no one here to fight. We have chosen Christ as our leader, and he taught men a different way." There seemed to be nothing left for us to do but to ride away, leaving the town unmolested. It was impossible to take it. If I had ordered my soldiers to fire on those smiling men and women and children, they would never have obeyed me. Even military discipline has its limits. Could I command the grisly soldier to shoot down the child who reminded him of his Lisa? I reported to the headquarters that the town had offered unassailable resistance, although this admission injured my military reputation. But I was right. We had literally been conquered by these simple folk who followed implicitly the leadership of Jesus Christ. It's a battle, and we win by reverse fighting. The world soldiers win by killing. Christians win by dying. Read Isaiah 53. You get down to the end. It says he's going to divide the spoil. Well, spoil is what you divide after the battle. How did he win the battle? By dying on that cross we had pictured here on the board last night. Christians fight in a reverse manner. They fight with love and forgiveness and death to themselves. Shall we bow our heads for a word of prayer?
Our Father, we thank